I think most people are aware when you think about the Sabbath day, the Sabbath was a day of rest. The word Sabbath is related to the Hebrew word for the number seven. So Sabbath was the seventh day, which would equal our Saturday. And when the first time the Sabbath is mentioned in any form of legislation, it's in the Old Testament in Exodus chapter 20, in the Ten Commandments. We're told in Exodus 20 verse 8, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. So Sabbath was a holy day. And he said that 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is in within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made earth and heaven and the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore God blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So number one, it was a day of rest. But what we sometimes forget is that it was also a day of worship in some sense. I don't know all the details about this, but in the book of Leviticus, in Leviticus chapter 23, in reminding them about the importance of the Sabbath, Leviticus 23 verse 3 said, 6 days work shall be done, but on the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest. And then it said, a holy convocation. You shall do no work. It is a Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwelling places. There was some kind of worship significance to it. Convocation is a coming together of some sort. And so we see that expressed in different ways. By the time you get to the New Testament, it kind of translated itself, at least as far as how the Jews practice it in New Testament times. They would meet on the Sabbath in the synagogues. You get a sense of that in Luke chapter 4 when it's speaking of Jesus. And in verse 16 of Luke 4, he came to Nazareth where he had been brought up. And as was his custom, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day and he stood up to read. So it was customary for Jews to assemble in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. And that was how, at least in New Testament times, they fulfilled the idea of the holy convocation. And I have reason for thinking that some of this may have begun back in the Old Testament before the exile. There's an interesting reference in Psalm 74, verse 8, where it says, they said to themselves, we will utterly subdue them, and they burned all the meeting places of God in the land. It's talking about those who had destroyed the land of Israel, probably a reference to the events leading up to the exile. And it said they destroyed the meeting places, plural. That's not talking about the temple. Apparently that's talking about various places where Israelites came together on a more or less regular basis. So even in the Old Testament, there appears to have been some ways in which the Israelites spent some time together on the Sabbath day in reflection and worship to God. Now, as I said, it's a holy day. When you get to the New Testament, we understand that Christians are not bound by the law of Moses. That's not to say we have no laws at all. That's not to say that we're not bound by anything. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9 in verse 21, to those outside the law, I became as one outside the law. He's talking about the law of Moses there. But in parenthesis, he says, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I may win those outside the law. We are under law to Christ. There are laws that govern our behavior. We're not bound by the law of Moses. And so when you start looking at some of the Old Testament legislation, obviously some of those things simply do not apply to us as Christians. The Sabbath would be one of them. If there is anything analogous to the local church in the Old Testament, I would argue it was probably the synagogues. They function very much like local churches do today, and one of the things they did was meet on the Sabbath. Sabbath is not binding for Christians. And obviously, local churches aren't supposed to be observing the Sabbath. We observe the first day of the week. But having said that, I do think it's interesting when you look at the attitude that the Jews had about the Sabbath, about this not just day of rest, but I'm more particularly interested in their view of this Sabbath as a holy convocation. Can we learn something from that? And I want to suggest that we can, and a way of looking at that is Psalm 92. So take your Bibles and turn to Psalm 92. Part of that was just read for us a few moments ago. I want you to look at the heading. Psalm 92 says it is a song for the Sabbath. The word psalm is the word mizmor. It means a sacred song, usually a song set to music. It occurs about 57 times in the headings of the Psalms, and 13 times it occurs with that second word, a song. The word song is shir. It's just vocal music of some sort. It's a fairly generic word. But it's telling us that this song was composed for the Sabbath. Now, this is the only heading in the Old Testament, at least in the Hebrew version of the Old Testament, that assigns a psalm to a day of the week. It's interesting that when you get to the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, it appeared about 200 years before the time of Christ. In the Septuagint, there are seven psalms that are assigned a different day of the week. The Sabbath day was assigned to Psalm 92, but Sunday, the first day of the week, was assigned Psalm number 24. Monday was assigned Psalm 48. Tuesday was assigned Psalm 82. Wednesday was assigned Psalm 94. Thursday was assigned Psalm 81. And Friday was assigned Psalm number 93. And apparently the priests used this in their liturgy. If you look at the background of Psalm 92, when the priests did their work in the temple, they used Psalm 92 on the Sabbath, this day of holy convocation, as a way of reminding themselves of the importance of the Sabbath and what they were doing there. So if you had to prepare for a day of worship, how would you do it? And I would suggest that Psalm 92 ain't a bad way of looking at it. Psalm 92 was one of their ways of preparing for their holy convocation. And let's just see what they have to do, what they have to say about it. I want to call this a Sabbath well spent. How did they use the Sabbath? How did they prepare for the Sabbath? And particularly the dimension of worship, this holy convocation. Obviously, for the Levites and the priests, there were things they had to do. Even if every other Jew was resting on that day, they had things they had to do. And business in the temple went on as normal. So it was something that was a day of, in a sense, it was a day of work for them. But more importantly, it was a day for worship. So when you look at this as preparation for worship, a day of worship should include, I want to suggest three things. Number one, praise for God's works. And that's what he emphasizes in the opening verses of Psalm 92. It is good to give thanks to the Lord and to sing praises to your name, O Most High, to declare your steadfast love in the morning and your faithfulness by night, to the music of the lute and the harp, to the melody of the lyre. For you, O Lord, have made me glad by your work. At the works of your hands, I sing for joy. He starts out, he says, it's good to do two things. It's good to give thanks to God, and it's good to give praise to God. Now, those are two ideas you see joined together pretty frequently in the Old Testament, especially in the book of Psalms, praise and thanksgiving. Praise and thanksgiving are closely related, but they're a little bit different. When the Bible talks about praise to God, it is acknowledging his attributes. When the Bible talks about thanksgiving to God, it is acknowledging his works on our behalf. When you thank God, you're thanking him for something he has done, particularly in relationship to you. When you're praising God, you're simply adoring and magnifying who and what he is. One deals with his attributes, that's praise. The other deals with his works, that is thanksgiving. And he says here, it's good to do both. It is good to give thanks to the Lord and to sing praises to your name, O Most High. And not only that, but he says in verse 2 that this is something that ought to be done 24/7. It's not just something we do on the Sabbath. And I think that may be one of the biggest problems that people have. Yes, for Christians, we don't worship on the Sabbath, but we worship on the first day of the week. And I'm sure Jews had this same problem as well. Well, the Sabbath is our day of worship. Well, actually, not really. It's not the only day of worship. For Christians, well, we worship on the first day of the week. That's true, but that's not the only time you do it. According to verse 2, to declare your steadfast love in the morning and your faithfulness by night. That's something you do all day, every day. in a sense, we never stop worshiping God. If we constantly think about His works and His attributes, if we're constantly thinking about the necessity of praise and thanksgiving, if we're always looking for opportunities to do that, then our praise and our thanksgiving, in other words, our worship, never ceases. So if you want to get the most out of worship on the first day of the week, it's something you ought to be doing every day. And it's also a personal thing as well. Obviously, for Israelites and the Sabbath, there was a corporate dimension to it, particularly when they got into the habit of coming into the synagogues, and they would have scripture readings, and they would have a lesson. They would do other things in their assemblies in the synagogue. There was a corporate dimension to it. And in the same way with our assemblies, when we come together on the first day of the week or at other times, there's a corporate dimension to it. But if you'll notice in verse 4, "For you, O Lord, have made me glad by your work. At the work of your hands, I sing for joy." Most of the verbs up to verse 4 are infinitives, which means they're just kind of generic in nature. It's good to do this. It's good to do that. But here in verse 4, he says, "I will sing." And that's first person singular. There he's emphasizing his personal obligation, his personal opportunity to express his thanks and his praise to God. So yes, there's a corporate dimension to worship, but there is also the idea of the personal dimension as well. It's something we do every day, morning and evening. And unless we're doing that, we're not going to get much out of our corporate experiences. A lot of times people, quote, come to church and then they leave somewhat deflated or somewhat flat, or they say, "Well, I just didn't get a whole lot out of that." Let me tell you, if you didn't put much into it prior to getting here, you're not going to get much out of it while you're here. Worship requires preparation, and it requires, as he says in verse 2, a daily dose of thanksgiving and praise, and it requires the personal dedication to praising God and constantly keeping Him in mind. A day of worship, then, ought to include praise for God's works. But it also ought to include reminders of God's justice. Now, it takes an interesting turn in verse 5. He goes from simply praising God for His works and His attributes. He says, "How great are your works, O Lord! Your thoughts are very deep." And so you might think, well, he's now going to reflect on the works of God. Well, he does, but he's not talking here about creation. He's talking about God's justice. He continues, "The stupid man cannot know. The fool cannot understand this, that though the wicked sprout like grass and all evildoers flourish, they are doomed to destruction forever. But you, O Lord, are on high forever. For behold your enemies, O Lord, for behold your enemies shall perish. All evildoers shall be scattered." Now, from the psalmist's perspective in verse 5, now he just talked about the works of God back in verse 4. "For you, O Lord, have made me glad by your work. At the works of your hands," he says, "I sing for joy." So the works of God cause him to pause and give praise and thanksgiving. The works of God cause him to pause and sing praises about that. But in verse 5, he says, the works of God also cause him to do something else. The works of God cause him to stop and think about God himself. "How great are your works, O Lord, your thoughts are very deep." When we stop and marvel at the handiwork of God, we cannot help but think deeply about the one who has done these things. What is this? When I look at the world around me, when I look at what God does in human history, when I see how God interacts with the nations, when I see God at work answering prayer, when I see God at work providing abundantly for His people, what does that make me think about? What does it make you think about? It ought to help us reflect deeply on the nature of God. It ought to help us reflect on His goodness, on His benevolence, on His magnificent power to provide all these things, on His wisdom to take all of these disparate things going on in the world and make them work together for His purposes. It ought to impress me with His wisdom that from the very beginning, even before the beginning of time, there was this magnificent plan that He executed perfectly in history. All of those things ought to come to mind as I reflect on the works of God. Your thoughts are very deep, O Lord. And to think about God requires some deep thought on our part. But then he turns in verse 6 and says, now, the stupid, this is the ESV, the stupid man cannot know, the fool cannot understand this. The New American Standard kind of reverses those two. He says, the senseless man, cannot know, and then he says, the stupid man cannot understand this. He's talking about people that act like animals. They don't give things a whole lot of thought. They just react out of instinct. He's talking about people who do not think deeply about things. I think there's a great deal of irony here. You know, through the years when I have dealt with skeptics, and particularly atheists and agnostics, they tend to view themselves as being greatly intellectual. And the psalmist says here, actually, the opposite problem is true. They just haven't thought deeply enough about things. And he uses two very unflattering words. He says they're stupid and they're fools. Now be careful about saying that to the guy across the table from you, but nonetheless, that's the psalmist's assessment. Their problem is not that they have thought so deeply and they're on this intellectual plane that the rest of us can't attain. That's not their problem at all. Their problem is they're not thinking deeply enough about this. And then he goes on to say not only are they foolish intellectually, but he actually says they're evil, they're wicked. Verse 7, that though the wicked sprout like grass and all evildoers flourish, they are doomed to destruction forever. Evildoers will ultimately, they flourish in this life, they are here, they're always going to be here, and yet ultimately they pass away. Think about that. This is such a wise observation in this psalm. What is it that unbelievers frequently harp about? Why do they complain about religion? Well, I can't reconcile a God who says he's good and the presence of evil in this world. I just can't get around that is what people say. Skeptics say that all the time. And you know what the psalmist says? He says the reason why they can't get around it is they're not thinking deeply about it, because he says according to this, that's part of God's plan. That's part of God's purpose. God can take evildoers and use them for his purposes. In our Sunday morning class in Isaiah, we have been talking about, we started a section today, Isaiah chapter 13 through about verse 23, 27, where he's talking about God's judgment against the nations. And he used the nations. I'm going to raise up this, I'll raise up the Assyrians, they'll do my will, and then I'll punish them. I'll raise up the Babylonians, they will do my purposes, they will accomplish what I want them to accomplish, and then I'll punish them if when they go too far. Later in the book, he calls Cyrus, who was a foreign king, wasn't even born yet, Cyrus, my servant, because he had purposes for this man named Cyrus. He would accomplish his purposes, and then he would be done with it. God can take evil and use it for his purposes, and he is perfectly just in what he does. He makes sure that justice is always done, and he says, as a consequence, he says, though the wicked sprout like grass and all evildoers flourish, they are doomed to destruction forever. But you, O Lord, are on high forever. God's exalted position gives him the perspective of omniscience. He knows all things that are going on. He knows all things that are happening. And because of that, he has a perspective that none of us have. And that perspective is ultimately verse 9. For behold your enemies, O Lord, for behold your enemies shall perish. All evildoers shall be scattered. Sometimes Christian, and I know in other countries, it's not so much of an issue here. We worry about it sometimes here in America. But we live at a point in history, and we live in a place on earth where we don't have to worry about our freedom. Now, maybe someday they may come away and take away our freedom and say you can't worship God however you want to. Right now, that's not a worry. We can come here 7 days a week if we want to. We can come here once a week if we want to. The law cannot say you can't meet. We have that freedom. And it's interesting that in Psalm 92, as the priests and Levites are going about their business, contemplating this day of holy convocation, one of the things they're thinking about is God is going to take care of the evildoers. And even if we lived in a place where worship was where Christians were persecuted for worship, or if we lived in a place where we had to get government permission to worship, Our thoughts ought to be on the living God who controls all of these things. Our thoughts ought to be on a God who ultimately will take care of the problem of evil. Even if we have to suffer some persecution in the meantime, so be it. Ultimately, it will suit God's purposes, and we have to trust Him to do that. So as they went about their worship on the Sabbath, they were reminded of God's justice. And then there is also gratitude for God's blessings, starting verse 10. But you have exalted my horn like that of the wild ox. You have poured over me fresh oil. My eyes have seen the downfall of my enemies. My ears have heard the doom of my evil assailants. The righteous flourish like the palm tree and grow like a cedar in Lebanon. They are planted in the house of the Lord. They flourish in the courts of our God. They still bear fruit in an old age. They are ever full of sap and green to declare that the Lord is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. Now, all through this section, he keeps talking about, my eyes have seen this. He talks about God being his rock. So he goes back to the personal element of this. But he declares at the end that he is grateful for the blessings of God. Goes back to a posture of thanksgiving. And so in verse 10 and 11, he starts out by thanking God or being grateful to God for the honor that has been bestowed upon him. Verse 10a, you have exalted my horn like that of the wild ox. I'm not entirely sure what that means. I do understand the idea of exaltation. I do understand the idea that God has lifted up the psalmist in some way and given him a position of distinction. And so there is the honor that God gives to his people. The second part of verse 10, though, speaks to the idea of blessing. So he has been honored by the Lord, and he has been refreshed and blessed by the Lord. He says in the second part of verse 10, you have poured over me fresh oil. Oil was considered a great blessing. Sometimes it's the idea of anointing. Sometimes it's the idea of healing. But oil was a symbol of blessing and refreshment. And not only that, in verse 11, he sees the downfall of his enemies. While speaking about his enemies in the middle part of the psalm, he now acknowledges God has taken care of that issue. He says in verse 11, my eyes have seen the downfall of my enemies. My ears have heard the doom of my evil assailants. And so he is free to continue worshiping God. The enemy shall not prevent that. The enemy cannot hinder him in any way. Ultimately, he rejoices that God has vindicated him. And then verses 12 through 15 really bring home the idea of fruitfulness and security in all of this. He talks about the righteous flourishing like the palm tree and growing like a cedar in Lebanon. The idea, and also in verse 14, they bear fruit in old age. They are ever full of sap and green. That's in contrast, by the way, back in verse 7. Remember how he described the evil? They're like grass that springs up. They flourish. But what happens to grass in a hot, dry, arid climate? It dies very quickly. We see that every summer. We get in the dry spell, and guess what? Your green grass turns brown. And you can imagine how that would have been in a place like Palestine. Not much grass to start with. And it does sprout up, but pretty soon there's no moisture. There's a hot temperature and a hot breeze, and what happens to it? It just wilts away. By contrast, the people of God are like what he describes in verse 12 and verse 14. They are firmly planted. Their roots go deep, and they're able to pull the moisture from the deep recesses of the soil. They're planted deeply, they're planted firmly, and so the Lord knows how to take care of them. They flourish when everything else is dying. It mentions here the cedars of Lebanon. I've seen pictures of the cedars of Lebanon. Beautiful, beautiful trees in a hot, dry climate. Because of their root system, they were able to draw moisture from the depths of the soil. And he says God's people are the same way. Ultimately, they bear fruit even in old age. Verse 13 also indicates, I think, the security that they have. Not only are they firmly planted, but they're firmly planted, he says, two things, in the house of the Lord and in the courts of our God. They are put in a special place where the evildoer cannot affect them, where the evildoer cannot reach them. Not only are they fruitful, but they're also secure. And then the ultimate purpose, he says in verse 15, is to declare that the Lord is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. All of this brings about, again, the praise of God because of his character and because of his works. So when you ask the question, so how did Jews typically get ready for their day of holy convocation? How did they get ready for the Sabbath? Psalm 92 is the answer. It was a song written for the Sabbath. Apparently it was something that the priests used in their ministrations as they went about the temple or the tabernacle getting ready for their worship. But I have a suspicion that a lot of righteous Jews also used this as well. Now, I want to make some applications. If you think about the nature of worship, I think each section of the psalm gives us something, gives us some kind of important principle about worship. The first section, verses 1 through 4, I think remind us of the basis of worship. Thomas Carlyle once said that wonder is the basis of worship. We don't worship things that we grasp. We don't worship things that we fully comprehend. We worship things that we don't understand. We are awestruck by the power of God, by the works of God. We wonder, we marvel, we stand back and look in awe at the deeds of God, and that's how the psalm begins. It is good to give thanks to the Lord. It is good to sing praises. What's the reason for that? He says in verse 4 and verse 5, because of the wondrous works of his hand. When we look at God, at his nature, when we look at God, at his works, we are moved to worship him. Wonder is the basis of worship, and if we ever lose that sense of wonder toward God, we will lose our capacity to worship. That's why the key to worship is constantly thinking about God and his nature and his works. I've said before, sometimes the best thing we can do is go outside and look around. Lift up our eyes to the heavens. Look at the trees around us. Listen to the birds. Look at the grass. Look at all of those wonderful things in God's creation. And as we see those things, we're reminded of the power and the goodness of God. Wonder is the basis of our worship. And I think the first part of the psalm helps us appreciate that. Second part of the psalm reminds us of the opposite of worship. Now, he starts out talking about thinking deeply about God. Then he turns around and says that that's the problem with evildoers. They're not thinking very deeply of God. What do evildoers think of? They think of themselves. They think of things that are less than God. They take parts of God's creation and exalt them. You know, these days it's popular to worship nature. These days it's popular to exalt nature above all else, including the one that created it. Anytime we take something that is less than God and exalt it, it's called idolatry, and that's the very antithesis of worship. Whether we're exalting ourselves or whether we're exalting some aspect of creation, it's the very opposite of worship. But let me tell you what, folks, we can be guilty of that. You ever gone home after worship and say, well, I didn't get much out of that. Boy, the song leader just really messed up. Or I'm not sure if that prayer was worded properly. Or, boy, I think the teacher just totally missed it in class today. Or that baby behind me was just crying too much. Or it was so hot in the building. Or this or that. And we can just go on and complain. What has happened? We've quit looking at God, and we started looking at self, or we started looking at others. And look, I understand. Sometimes those distractions happen. I understand that sometimes, well, maybe the song leading wasn't the best. Or I understand that sometimes, yeah, babies make noise. I understand that sometimes, yeah, it's a little bit stuffy in the building. I recognize sometimes the preacher makes weird points. That kind of stuff happens. But the question is, are we so focused on self? Are we so focused on the human aspect of it that we forget this is about God? And as soon as we forget about that, we have taken something besides God and exalted it to his level. The antithesis of worship is the worship of self or the worship of something less than God. So it's so easy to get caught up in those things, caught up in the mechanics of worship or the components of worship. And in doing that, we miss out on the glory of our God and how he manifests himself to us in every situation. So this song, the middle part of the psalm, verses 5 through 9, remind us what worship really is and what worship really isn't. And then finally, we need to remember the fruit of worship. I've seen this slogan before. I know when I lived in Louisville, we used to have some announcements that looped on the PowerPoint screen before services. And for 1 year, every year we try to put up a new slogan. But in 1 year, our slogan was, enter to worship, leave to serve. That's a great slogan. That's a great thing to remember. We come in here to worship God, but we leave ready to serve on a day-to-day basis. If we leave here and do nothing as a result of our worship, we didn't worship, or we didn't worship properly, or we did not worship completely. When we leave here, we ought to be strengthened and fortified and exhorted and excited about the opportunities for service that each day of the week will bring to us. Worship is not, for the Jews, was not just a Sabbath event, and worship for us is not just a first day of the week event. If we view it as such, we're missing out on the great opportunities that we have for service. And I love that he ends the psalm by talking about fruitfulness. As he contemplates the works of God, as he contemplates this holy day of convocation, what he also contemplates is the bearing of fruit in his life that manifests the power of God and reflects the goodness of God. The people of God ought to always bear fruit. We can only do that if we are deeply planted in the works and the goodness of God. So fruitful service is part of worship as well. When I lived in Iowa, or when we lived in Iowa, I spent, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years delivering papers. That's how we paid for our son Nathaniel. And wonderful way. I had to get up. The papers were delivered to a little bank about 3 blocks from where we lived. We lived in a small town. And they would drop off the papers Monday through Saturday at 4 in the morning. So I go there at 4 in the morning. Morning person that I am. I stagger out of bed and weave all over the road and get to the bank. And hopefully by that time I'm awake. Put together the papers and go deliver them. On Sundays, they got there at 2 in the morning. Because there was at least 2 sections of the paper. A lot of times there were 3 sections. You had more subscribers on Sunday, bigger paper. Sunday was an exceedingly long day for that year and a half, 2 years. But anyway, get up at 4 in the morning, or at 2 in the morning, go deliver papers. They had to be delivered by 7. Technically, they had to be delivered by 7:30. I always shot for 7 or sooner. But anyway, I as I would be finishing up my route, I would notice on Sunday mornings at about 5 in the morning, people start stirring around. Monday through Saturday, nobody was stirring at 5 in the morning. On Sunday, everybody's stirring at 5 in the morning. Not because they're getting ready to worship, they're getting ready to go fishing. They're getting ready to go to the family picnic. They're getting ready to go to the lake. They're getting ready to go golfing. I saw more life early Sunday morning than I saw any other day of the week. I saw more life early on Sunday morning than I did the rest of the week put together. They have missed the idea of bearing fruit for God. We exist to serve Him. We exist to serve others as our way of serving Him. We exist to bear fruit and bring Him glory. And if worship does not create in us a greater capacity for bearing fruit, and if it does not create in us a greater desire to bear fruit, then it must not be worship. It's got to be something less than that. And so as we look at Psalm 92, you know, we are privileged that we have a day of the week where God has appointed for us a day of worship. Now, obviously, Sunday is not a holy day in the same sense that the Sabbath was. There are some differences. But I do think it's interesting that Psalm 92 was dedicated to the Sabbath, their day of holy convocation. And what were they thinking about? They were thinking about the works of God. They were thinking about the justice of God. And they were thinking about bearing fruit for God. And I think that's a great lesson for us. We are privileged as the people of God to be able to worship Him. As I said, here in this country, we have the freedom to do it whenever we want to. Pretty much however we want to. We don't have to get a lot of government regulations about all this stuff. We just come and do it. What a privilege it is, and yet so often we neglect that privilege. But do we also take advantage of that privilege? Do we take advantage of the opportunity to be here? And while we're here, do we take advantage of it to the fullest and enjoy it? and bring glory to God and concentrate our thinking on Him and His works and all that that means for us? And then do we really take advantage of it by leaving here better fit to be His servants? If that's not what worship does for us, apparently we're not worshiping in the right way. We need to make some corrections. If you're here tonight and you need spiritual help in your life in any possible way, maybe you're not a Christian and you need to obey Jesus as Lord. Maybe you are a Christian and you're struggling in some way in your life. We want to help you. So let us know about it while we stand and sing.